Disc 5. The revelation which now came is known as the Surah of Banning, because it opens with a reproof to the Prophet for having banned Maria from his life. O Prophet, why bannest thou, to please thy wives, that which God hath made lawful unto thee? Then, having formally absolved him from his oath, it addresses Hafsa and Aisha, though not by name. If ye twain repent unto God, ye have cause, for your hearts were set upon the ban. And if ye aid each the other against him, verily God, even he, is his protecting friend, and Gabriel and the elect of the faithful. And beyond these, the angels are massed to help him. The next verse is addressed to all the wives. It may be, if he divorce you, that his Lord will give him wives in your stead who are better than you, submissive unto God, believing, devout, penitent, inclined unto worship and fasting, widows and virgin maids. The surah ends with examples from sacred history of two evil women and two women who were perfect. God citeth, as example for those who disbelieve, the wife of Noah and the wife of Lot. They were under two righteous men from amongst our slaves, men whom they betrayed, and who thus availed them naught against God. And it was said unto both, Enter ye the fire with them who enter it. And God citeth as example for those who believe, the wife of Pharaoh, when she said, My Lord, build for me a dwelling with thee in paradise, and save me from Pharaoh and his deeds, and save me from the people who transgress. And Mary, the daughter of Imran, who kept chaste her womb, and we breathed therein of our spirit. And she testified to the truth of the words of her Lord and his scriptures, and was of those who were absorbed in prayer. When he had recited this revelation to his wives, the Prophet left them to meditate upon it, and withdrew to a roofed veranda, which was the only room he had but for their apartments. News spread throughout Medina that he had divorced his wives, and it came to the ears of Umar that night. At dawn he went as usual to the mosque, but immediately after the prayer, before Umar could address him, the Prophet withdrew to his porch. Umar went to Hafsa and found her in tears. Why weepest thou? He said, adding, before she could answer, Did I not tell thee this would happen? Hath God's messenger divorced you? I know not, she said, but he is there, secluded by himself in that porch. Its entrance was from the mosque, to which Umar now returned. There were gathered a group of men sitting round the pulpit. Some of them were in tears. Umar sat with them for a while, and then, unable to endure his feelings, he went to the door of the porch, where a black Abyssinian boy, a servant of the Prophet, was standing. "Ask permission for Umar to enter," he said to the boy, who went in and then came out after a moment, saying, "I mentioned thee to him, but he was silent." Umar returned to where he had been sitting. Then he went again to ask if he might enter, and again he was told that the Prophet had made no response. This happened yet a third time. But just as Umar had turned away, the boy called out to him that the Prophet had said he might enter. Umar went in and found him reclining on a rush mat. His back, which was partly bare, showed clearly the marks of the matting where it had pressed against his skin. A leather cushion, stuffed with palm fibre, was at his side, and on this he was leaning. His eyes were downcast, and he did not look at Umar as he entered. O Messenger of God, said Umar, hast thou divorced thy wives? The Prophet raised his eyes to Umar. Nay, I have not, he said.
Allahu Akbar!
Exclaimed Umar in a voice which could be heard in all the neighbouring houses. Salama said afterwards, I was weeping, and when anyone came unto me, they said, Hath God's messenger divorced thee? And I said, By God, I know not. This continued until Umar came to the Prophet. We heard his magnification. We were all in our apartments, and we knew that the messenger of God had answered nay to his question. There was, in fact, only one question in anybody's mind, and they were certain that Umar would be especially preoccupied with it on account of his daughter. "I stood there," said Umar, "feeling my way with the messenger of God as to what was his state, and I said, 'We were used to having, we men of Quraysh, the upper hand over our wives, but when we came to Medina, we came unto a people whose wives have the upper hand over them.'" He saw a suggestion of a smile cross the prophet's face, so he went on to tell him what he had previously said to Hafsa by way of warning, and again the prophet smiled, whereupon he ventured to sit down. Once more he was struck by the bareness of the room, a mat on the floor, 3 leather cushions, and nothing else. He suggested that the prophet should allow himself more luxury, and by way of contrast he mentioned the Greeks and the Persians, but he was cut short with the words, "Art thou in any doubt, O son of Khattab? Their good things have been hastened on for them in this their earthly life." It was now the time of the new moon, and the prophet let it be known to his wives that he did not wish to see any of them until the month had passed. When the moon had altogether waned, he went first to Aisha's apartment. Delighted to see him, yet surprised, she said to him, "It is but 29 nights." "How dost thou know?" he asked, and she answered, "I have been counting them. How I have counted them!" "But this was a month of 29, he said. She had forgotten that a lunar month is sometimes only 29 days instead of 30. He then told her of another revelation he had received, which made it necessary for him to put before her a choice between 2 possibilities. He said he had asked her father to help him by counselling her in this matter. "Nay," said Aisha, "none shall help thee with regard to me, but tell me what it is, O messenger of God." He answered, saying, "God putteth before thee this choice." And then he recited the newly revealed verses. "O prophet, say unto thy wives, if ye desire this lower life and its adornments, then come and I will bestow its goods upon you, and I will release you with a fair release. But if ye desire God and his messenger and the abode of the hereafter, then verily God hath laid in store for you a meed immense for such of you as do good." She said, "Verily I desire God and his messenger and the abode of the hereafter." And there was not one of his wives who did not say the same. The months drew on, until almost a year had passed since the signing of the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. It was now time to set off for Mecca in accordance with the promise of Quraysh that the Prophet and his companions should have safe access to the holy precinct in order to perform the rite of the lesser pilgrimage. There were about 2,000 pilgrims in all, including the would-be pilgrims of the previous year, except for a few who had died or been killed in battle. Amongst those who had not been at Hudaybiyah was Abu Huraira, a man of the Bani Daus. He had arrived in Medina with others of his tribe during the campaign of Kebar, and being destitute, he had joined the people of the Bench. On entering Islam, his name had been changed to Abdurrahman, but he was always known as Abu Huraira, the kitten man, literally the father of a kitten, because, like the Prophet, he was very fond of cats and often had a kitten to play with. He soon found favour with the Prophet, who, on this occasion, put him in charge of some of the sacrificial camels. When they heard that the pilgrims had reached the edge of the sacred territory, Quraysh vacated the whole of the hollow of Mecca and withdrew to the tops of the surrounding hills. The chiefs of Quraysh were gathered together on Mount Abu Qubais, from which they could look down into the mosque. They also had a wide view of the surrounding country. And now they saw the pilgrims emerge in a long file from the northwestern pass, which leads down into the valley just below the city. Their ears soon caught an indistinct murmur, which quickly became distinguishable as the age-old pilgrim's cry, "Labbaik Allahumma labbaik." He Here I am, O God, at thy service. The long procession of bareheaded, white-robed men was led by the prophet, mounted on Kaswa. Of the others, some were on camelback and some on foot. They made straight for the holy house by the nearest way. Each man was wearing his upper garment as a cloak, but at the entrance to the mosque, the prophet adjusted his, passing it under his right arm, leaving the shoulder bare, and crossing the two ends over the left shoulder, so that they hung down back and front. The others followed his example. Still mounted, he rode to the southeast corner of the Kaaba and reverently touched the black stone with his staff. Then he made the seven circuits of the house, after which he withdrew to the foot of the little hill of Safa and passed to and fro between it and the hill of Marwa, seven courses in all, ending at Marwa, to which many of the sacrificial animals had now been led. There he sacrificed a camel, and his head was shaved. This completed the rite of the lesser pilgrimage. He then returned to the mosque, intending to enter the holy house, cluttered with idols though it was. But the doors were locked, and the key was with a member of the clan of Abd ad-Dar. The prophet sent a man to ask for it, but the chiefs of Quraysh replied that this was not in their agreement, the entry into the house not being part of the pilgrimage rite. So none of the Muslims entered it that year. But when the sun had reached its zenith, the prophet told Bilal to go up to the roof of the Kaaba and make the call to prayer. His resonant voice filled the whole valley of Mecca and floated up to the tops of the hills, first with the magnification, then with the two testifications of Islam. I bear witness that there is no God but God. I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger of God. From Abu Qubais, the chiefs of Quraysh could plainly distinguish Bilal, and they were outraged at the sight of the black slave on the roof of the holy house. But above all, they were conscious that this was a triumph for the enemy, which might have incalculable repercussions, and they bitterly regretted having signed the treaty, which a year ago had seemed to be in their favour. The pilgrims spent 3 days in the evacuated city before returning to Medina. The prophet's entry into Mecca had been witnessed by the most eminent men of Quraysh. But there had been one notable exception. Khalid was not on Abu Qubais, nor was he encamped on any of the other hills above Mecca. He had withdrawn from the city well in advance of the prophet's approach. Khalid had for some years now been a man of two minds. Outwardly, this had not been evident. His military prowess had thrust him to the fore in every action that Quraysh had taken against the prophet. But he confessed afterwards that he had come away from Uhud and from the trench with the uneasy feeling that the battle had been pointless and that Muhammad would triumph in the end. And when the prophet had eluded his squadron on the way to Hudaybiyah, Khalid had exclaimed, "The man is inviolably protected." That had been his last action against Islam. Recently, Khalid had had a dream in which he was aware of being in a country which was shut in on all sides and extremely barren. Then he went out from his confinement into a land which was green and fertile, with pastures which stretched far and wide. He knew that this was something of a vision, and having divined the essence of its meaning, he made up his mind to go to Medina. He was joyfully received there, and Khalid said of the prophet, "His face shone with light as he returned my greeting of peace." He then pledged allegiance. "I bear witness that there is no God but God, and thou art the messenger of God." "Praise be to God who hath guided thee," said the prophet. "I ever saw in thee an intelligence which I hoped would not bring thee in the end to anything but good." "O messenger of God," said Khalid, "thou didst see all those fields of battle whereon I took part against thee in obstinate resistance to the truth. Pray therefore unto God that he may forgive me them." "Islam cutteth away all that went before it," said the prophet. "Even so much as that," said Khalid, still visibly troubled in conscience. And the prophet prayed, "O God, forgive Khalid, for all his obstructing of the way to thy path. The earlier half of this same year of rejoicing, the 8th year after the Hijrah, was also a time of bereavement. The first of the deaths in the household of the Prophet was that of his daughter Zainab. He was with her at the end, and spoke words of comfort to his son-in-law and little granddaughter. Then he led the funeral prayer, and prayed also beside her grave. Khadija was the only one of his wives who had borne him children. The people of Medina longed that a child should be born to the Prophet in their city. At each new marriage, the citizens were filled with fresh hopes, which gradually faded, for not one of the later wives was destined to be the mother of a child to the Prophet. Yet now, shortly after the death of his eldest daughter, it appeared that he was again to become a father. Maria, his Coptic bondmaid, was expecting a child. She was already a centre of attention for the people of Medina, who knew well the Prophet's affection for her, and who sought to please him by their kindness to her. And now their attentiveness was redoubled. About 3 months after his return from the lesser pilgrimage, the Prophet sent 15 men to act as peaceful messengers of Islam to one of the tribes on the borders of Syria. But their friendly greetings were met by a shower of arrows, and having been obliged to fight, they were all killed but one. There was another setback, smaller in that it involved only a single death, but of greater political import. A messenger to Bostra was intercepted by a chief of the tribe of Ghassan and put to death. Such an act could not be allowed to go unpunished, despite the risk that the Ghassanids, who were mainly Christian, might be able to persuade Caesar's representative to send them help. The Prophet mustered an army of 3,000 men and put Zayd in command of them, with instructions that if Zayd should be killed, Jaffa should take his place. Abdullah ibn Rawaha was named as third in order of precedence. If these three should all be incapacitated, the men were to follow a commander of their own choosing. The Prophet then gave Zayd a white standard, and with others of his companions he accompanied the army to where the ground rises up towards the Pass of Farewell, an opening between the hills a little to the north of Uhud. When the army reached the Syrian border, they heard that not only had the northern tribes come out in considerable strength, but that Caesar's representative had greatly reinforced them with imperial troops. Altogether, the enemy was said to be 100,000 strong. Allowing for the probability of gross exaggeration, Zayd nonetheless decided to halt and to hold a council of war. Most of the men were in favour of sending immediately to inform the Prophet of this grave turn of events. Then he could either order them home or give them auxiliaries. But Abdullah spoke vigorously against any such course. Using the same unanswerable argument which had been used before Uhud and which was to be used again and again in the future, he ended his speech with the words, "We have before us the certainty of one of two good things, either victory or martyrdom, to join our brethren and be their companions in the gardens of paradise. On then to the attack!" Abdullah's resolution prevailed, and the army continued its northward advance. They were now not far from the southern end of the Dead Sea, separated from its long and deep valley by the range of hills which rises up from its eastern shores. A few hours' march brought them within sight of the enemy. Whatever the exact numbers of the combined Arab and Byzantine forces, the Muslims could see at a glance that they themselves were vastly outnumbered on a scale which they had never yet experienced. Nor had any of them witnessed before such military splendour as that of the imperial squadrons which formed the centre of the host, with the Arabs on either flank. The pomp of Quraysh, as they had descended the hill of Akankal at Badr, had been as nothing to the wealth of arms and armour and the richly caparisoned horses which now met their eyes. Their approach, moreover, had been anticipated, and the legions were ready for them, drawn up in battle formation. Wishing to avoid an immediate engagement, for the slope of the land was against them, Zayd gave orders to withdraw southwards to Mutta, where they would have the advantage, and there they consolidated their position. The enemy, conscious of the great superiority of their numbers, and bent on making it an altogether decisive day, followed them to Mutta. As they drew near, instead of retreating further as they had expected, Zayd gave the order to attack. At that moment, the space between Mutta and Medina was folded up for the Prophet, and he saw Zayd with the white standard leading his men into battle. He saw him many times mortally wounded, until finally he fell to the ground, and Ja'far took the standard and fought until his life also flowed out from his wounds. Then Abdullah took the standard, and the attack which he led against the enemy was repulsed with a vigorous onslaught in which he too was killed, and his men driven back in disarray. Another helper, Thabit ibn Arkam, seized the standard, and the Muslims rallied, whereupon he gave it to Khalid, who at first refused the honour, saying that Thabit had more right to it. "Take it, man," said Thabit, "I did but take it to give it thee." So Khalid took command and knit the ranks together, and the enemy advance was so firmly checked that they drew back enough to enable the Muslims to beat an orderly retreat. It was a victory for the other side, but they gained no advantage from it. And of the Muslims, apart from their three leaders, only five were killed. It was thus something of a victory for Khalid. And when the Prophet told his companions of the battle, and of the deaths of Zayd and Ja'far and Abdullah, he said, "Then one of God's swords took the standard, and God opened up the way for them," that is, for the Muslims to reach safety. And thus it was that Khalid came to be called the Sword of God. As the Prophet described the battle, the tears were flowing down his cheeks, and when the time came for the prayer, he led it and immediately withdrew from the mosque, instead of turning to face the congregation, as was his wont. He did the same again at sunset, and yet again after the night prayer. The setback at Mutta was an encouragement to the northern Arabs to strengthen their resistance to the new Islamic state, and in the following month news came that the tribes of Bali and Kuda'a were massing in considerable numbers on the Syrian border with intent to march south. But this time there appeared to be no question of reinforcements from Caesar. The Prophet sent an army of 300 men with instructions to fight where necessary and to win allies where possible. By dint of night marches and relatively secluded camps, they avoided attracting undue attention and reached the Syrian border in 10 days. As they advanced, the enemy dispersed. There was only one brief exchange of arrows. For the rest, it was a question of coming upon deserted camps whose very recent occupants had vanished. And in the absence of the hostile clans, friendly elements, individuals and groups, ventured to manifest themselves. So Islam was able to claim that it had re-established its influence upon the Syrian frontier. That influence was now rapidly growing throughout the tribes on all sides of the Yathrib oasis. The reasons were not purely spiritual. The Prophet was now known as a dangerous and incalculable enemy, and as a powerful, reliable and generous ally. By comparison, other alliances were beginning to seem less attractive and more hazardous. In many cases, the political and religious motives were inextricably connected. But there was also a factor, slow working, yet powerful and profound, which had nothing whatsoever to do with politics, and which was also largely independent of the deliberate efforts made by the believers to spread the message of Islam. This was the remarkable serenity which characterized those who practiced the new religion. The Quran, the book of God's oneness, was also the book of mercy and the book of paradise. The recitation of its verses, combined with the teaching of the messenger, imbued the believers with the certainty that they had within easy reach, that is, through the fulfillment of certain conditions, well within their capacity, the eternal satisfaction of every possible desire. The resulting happiness was a criterion of faith. The Prophet insisted, "All is well with the faithful, whatever the circumstances." Despite the treaty, some of the men of Bakr were still determined to prolong their feud with Khuza'a, and not long after the campaign to Syria, a clan of Bakr made a night raid against Kuzaha, one of whom was killed. In the fighting which ensued, some of which took place inside the sacred territory, Quraysh helped their allies with weapons, and one or two men of Quraysh took part in the fighting under cover of darkness. The Bani Ka'b of Kuzaha immediately sent a deputation to Medina to inform the Prophet of what had happened and to ask for his help. He told them they could rely on him, and sent them back to their territory. When they had gone, he went to Aisha, who could see from his face that he was in great anger. He asked for some water to perform his ablution, and she heard him say, as he poured it over himself, "May I not be helped if I help not the sons of Ka'b?" Meantime, the Meccans were exceedingly troubled as to the possible consequences of what had happened, and they sent Abu Sufyan to pacify the Prophet, if need be. On his way, he met the men of Kuzaha returning home, and he feared he was too late. His fears were increased by the inscrutable demeanor of the Prophet. "O Muhammad," he said, "I was absent at the time of the Truce of Hudaybiyah, so let us now strengthen the pact and prolong its duration." The Prophet parried his request with the query, "Hath aught befallen to break it on your side?" "God forbid," said Abu Sufyan uneasily. "We likewise," said the Prophet, "are keeping to the truce for the period agreed upon at Hudaybiyah. We will not modify it, neither will we accept another in its place." He was clearly not prepared to say more, and the Umayyad chief returned to Mecca with great misgivings. The Prophet began to prepare for a campaign, and Abu Bakr asked if he also should make ready. The Prophet said he should, and told him that they were going out against Quraysh. "Must we not wait for the time of the truce to run out?" said Abu Bakr. "They have betrayed us and broken the pact," said the Prophet, "and I shall attack them. But keep secret what I have told thee. Let one thinker think that God's messenger is for Syria, and let another think he is for Thaqif, and another for Hawazin. O God, take from Quraysh all sight of us, and all tidings of us, what we are about, that we may come suddenly upon them in their land." The Prophet now sent messengers to those of the tribes whom he felt he could now rely on for help, with a general summons to be present in Medina at the beginning of the next month, which was Ramadan. The Bedouin faithfully responded, and when the appointed day came, the army was the largest that had ever set out from Medina. No able-bodied Muslim stayed behind. The emigrants were 700, with 300 horse. The helpers were 4,000, with 500 horse. And the tribes, including those who joined them on the way, brought the total numbers up to nearly 10,000 men. The cavalry rode on camelback, leading their horses. And except for a few of the closest companions, none of them knew who the enemy were. As to Quraysh, they were conscious of having broken the pact. This, together with the Prophet's refusal to renew it, made them apprehensive almost to the point of despair. The Prophet was aware of this, and in order to increase their fears, he ordered his men to spread out and each man to light a fire after dark. From the outskirts of the sacred territory, 10,000 campfires could now be seen burning, and news was quickly brought to Mecca that Muhammad's army was far larger than they had feared. After a hurried consultation, Quraysh accepted the offer of Abu Sufyan to go out and speak to the Prophet again. With him went Hakim, Khadija's nephew, and Budail of Kuzaha, who had helped the Prophet at Hudaybiyah, and who had recently accompanied some of his clansmen to Medina in connection with the rupture of the pact. As they approached the camp, already within earshot of the grumbling of the camels, they saw a man on a white mule coming apparently to meet them. It was Abbas, who had slipped out of the camp, hoping to find someone on his way to the city who could take a message for him to Quraysh. It was imperative, he thought, that they should send a deputation to the Prophet before it was too late. When they had recognized and greeted each other, Abbas took them to the tent of the Prophet, and Abu Sufyan said, "O Muhammad, thou hast come with a strange assortment of men, some known and some unknown, against thy kindred. But the prophet cut him short. It is thou who art the transgressor, he said. Ye broke the pact of Hudaybiyah and abetted the attack on the Bani Kaab, thereby sinfully violating the holy precinct of God and his sanctuary. Then he said to the three men, Bear witness that there is no God but God, and that I am the messenger of God. Hakim and Budail thereupon made their professions of faith, but Abu Sufyan testified, There is no God but God, and then was silent. When told to pronounce the second testification, he said, O Muhammad, there is still in my soul a scruple about this. Give her a respite. So the prophet told his uncle to take them to his tent for the night. At dawn the call to prayer was made throughout the camp, and Abu Sufyan was greatly shaken by the sound of it. What are they about? He said. The prayer, said Abbas. And how often do they pray each day and night? Said Abu Sufyan. And when told that the prayers were five, he said, By God, it is too much. Then he saw the men eagerly crowding and jostling each other, that they might be splashed with water from the prophet's ablution, or have some drops of what was left from it. And he said, O Abul Fadl, I have never seen such sovereignty as this. Out upon thee, said Abbas, believe. Take me to him, said Abu Sufyan. And after the prayer, Abbas took him again to the prophet, and he testified to his prophethood that he was indeed the messenger of God. Abbas took the prophet aside and said, O messenger of God, well knowest thou the love of Abu Sufyan for honour and glory. Grant him therefore some favour. I will, said the prophet. And going to the Umayyad chief, he told him to return to Quraysh and say to them, Whoso entereth the house of Abu Sufyan shall be safe, and whoso locketh upon himself his door shall be safe, and whoso entereth the mosque shall be safe. The tents had already been loaded onto the transport camels, and the prophet had at last called for the standards and pennants to be brought to him. These he mounted one by one, placing each in the hand of the bearer he had chosen for it. He told Abbas to accompany Abu Sufyan as far as the narrow end of the valley and keep him there so that he could see for himself the size of the army as it passed. There would be time enough for him then to return to Quraysh and deliver his message, for a single man could reach Mecca by a more direct way than the army would take. When the army had passed, Abu Sufyan went back to Mecca with all speed, and standing outside his house, he shouted at the top of his voice to a quickly gathering crowd, O men of Quraysh, Muhammad is here with a force ye cannot resist. Muhammad is here with 10,000 men of steel, and he hath granted me that whoso entereth my house shall be safe. Hind now came out of the house and seized her husband by his moustaches. Slay this greasy good-for-nothing bladder of a man, she cried, thou miserable protector of a people. Woe betide you, he shouted, let not this woman deceive you against your better judgment, for there hath come unto you that which ye cannot resist. But whoso entereth the house of Abu Sufyan shall be safe. God slay thee, they said, what good is thy house for all our numbers? And whoso locketh upon himself his door shall be safe, he answered, and whoso entereth the mosque shall be safe. Whereupon the crowd that had gathered dispersed, some to their houses and some to the mosque. The army halted at Du Thuwa, which is not far from the city and within sight of it. This was the place where, 2 years previously, Khalid had been stationed to bar their approach. But now there was no sign of any resistance. It was as if the city were empty, as it had been at their visit the previous year. But this time there was no 3-day limit to their stay. And when Kaswa came to a halt, the prophet bowed his head until his beard almost touched the saddle, in gratitude to God. He then drew up his troops, putting Khalid in command of the right and Zubair in command of the left. His own troop, which was now in the centre, he divided into two. Half of it was to be led by Sa'd and his son, and the other half, in which he himself would ride, was to be led by Abu Ubaidah. When the order was given, they were to divide and to enter the city from four directions, Khalid from below and the others from the hills, through three different passes. High above the gathered host, on the slopes of Mount Abu Qubais, Ikrimah, Safwan and Suhail had gathered a force of Quraysh together with some of their allies of Bakr and Hudayl. They were determined to fight, and when they saw Khalid's troop making for the lower entrance to the city, they came down and attacked them. But they were no match for Khalid and his men, who put them to flight, having killed some 30 of them, with the loss of only 2 lives on their own side. The fight was almost at an end when the Prophet entered through the pass of Adakir into Upper Mecca. Looking down towards the marketplace, he was dismayed to see the flash of drawn swords. "Did I not forbid fighting?" he said. But when it was explained to him what had happened, he said that God had ordained it for the best. He performed the rite of the greater ablution and prayed 8 cycles of prayer, after which he rested for an hour or more. Then he called for Kaswa, and having put on his coat of mail and his helmet, he girt on his sword. But in his hand he carried a staff, and his visor was up. Some of those who had ridden with him that morning were already in line outside the tent, and they made an escort for him as he went to the mosque, talking to Abu Bakr, who was at his side. He rode straight to the southeast corner of the Kaaba and reverently touched the black stone with his staff, uttering as he did so a magnification. Those who were near him repeated it. "Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!" And it was taken up by all the Muslims in the mosque, and the whole of Mecca resounded with it, until the Prophet motioned them to silence with his hand. Then he made the 7 rounds of the Holy House. The Prophet now turned away from the Kaaba towards the idols which surrounded it in a wide circle, 360 in all. Between these and the house he now rode, repeating the verse of the revelation, "The truth hath come, and the false hath vanished. Verily the false is ever a vanisher." And pointing at the idols, one by one, with his staff. And each idol, as he pointed at it, fell forward on its face. Having completed the circle, he dismounted and prayed at the station of Abraham, which was at that time adjoining the Kaaba. Then he went to the well of Zamzam, where Abbas gave him to drink, and he confirmed for ever the traditional rite of the sons of Hashim to water the pilgrims. The Meccans who had taken refuge in the mosque had since been joined by many of those who had at first taken refuge in their homes, and they were sitting in groups, here and there, not far from the Kaaba. The Prophet now addressed them, saying, "What say ye, and what think ye?" They answered, "We say well, and we think well. A noble and generous brother, son of a noble and generous brother, it is thine to command." He then spoke to them in the words of forgiveness, which, according to the revelation, Joseph spoke to his brothers when they came to him in Egypt. "Verily I say, as my brother Joseph said, this day there shall be no upbraiding of you nor reproach. God forgiveth you, and he is the most merciful of the merciful." Having given orders that Hubal, the largest of the fallen idols, should be broken to pieces, and that all of them should be burned, the Prophet had it proclaimed throughout the city that everyone who had an idol in his house must destroy it. He then withdrew to the nearby hill of Safa, where he had first preached to his family. Here he received the homage of those of his enemies who now wished to enter Islam, both men and women, and they came to him in hundreds. Then, after a number of days, the Prophet returned with his army to Medina. There they found Ibn Ubay seriously ill, and after a few weeks it was clear that he was dying. The traditional accounts differ as to the state of soul in which he died, but all are unanimous that the Prophet led the funeral prayer for him and prayed beside his grave when he had been buried. According to one tradition, when the Prophet had already taken his stand for the prayer, Umar went to him and protested against the bestowal of such grace upon a hypocrite. But the Prophet answered him, saying with a smile, "Stand thou behind me, Umar. I have been given the choice, and I have chosen. It hath been said unto me, Ask forgiveness for them, or ask it not. Though thou ask forgiveness for them 70 times, yet will not God forgive them." And did I know that God would forgive him if I prayed more than 70 times, I would increase the number of my supplications. Then he led the prayer, and walked beside the bier to the cemetery, and stood beside his grave. Not long afterwards the verse was revealed with reference to the hypocrites, "And never pray the funeral prayer over one of them who dieth, nor stand beside his grave, for verily they disbelieved in God and his messenger, and died in their iniquity." But according to other traditions, this verse had been revealed previously, nor was it any longer applicable to Ibn Ubay, for the Prophet visited him in his illness and found that the imminence of death had changed him. He asked the Prophet to give him a garment of his own in which he could be shrouded, and to accompany his body to the grave, which the Prophet agreed to do. Then again he spoke, saying, "O Messenger of God, I hope that as part of the revelation thou wilt pray beside my bier and ask forgiveness of God for my sins." Again the Prophet assented, and after his death he did as he had promised. The dead man's son, Abdullah, was present on all these occasions. It was now clear that they had not long to wait for the birth of Maria's child. Salma, who had attended on Khadija at the birth of all her children, was now an elderly woman. It was 25 years since she had helped to bring Fatima into the world, but she nonetheless insisted that she would do the same for this new child of the Prophet. So when the birth was thought to be imminent, she moved to the quarter where Maria lived in Upper Medina. The child was born at night, and that same night Gabriel had come to the Prophet and addressed him as never before, "O father of Ibrahim." Immediately after the birth, Salma sent her husband, Abu Rafi, to tell the Prophet that he had a son. And the next morning at the mosque, after the dawn prayer, the Prophet told his companions of the birth. "And I have named him," he added, "by the name of my father, Ibrahim." There was great rejoicing in Medina, and strong rivalry among the women of the helpers as to who should be the foster mother. The choice fell on the wife of a blacksmith in Upper Medina who lived near the babe's mother, and the Prophet would visit his son nearly every day and would often take his siesta there. Sometimes Ibrahim was brought to his father's house. Aisha said that one day the Prophet brought him to her in his arms and said, "Behold his likeness unto me." "I see no likeness," she said. "Dost thou not see how fair of skin he is, and how fine of flesh?" said the Prophet. "All that are fed on the milk of ewes are plump and fair of skin," she answered. One of the shepherds had instructions to send milk every day to the child's foster mother. But the untroubled happiness of this time came to an end with the illness of Ibrahim. It was soon clear that he would not survive. He was tended by his mother and her sister, Sirin. The Prophet visited him continually and was with him when he was dying. As the child breathed his last, he took him in his arms and tears flowed from his eyes. His forbidding of vociferous lamentation had made prevalent the notion that all expressions of woe at bereavement were to be discouraged, and the mistaken idea still lingered on in many minds. "O Messenger of God," said Abdurrahman ibn Auf, who was present, "this is what thou hast forbidden. When the Muslims see thee weeping, they too will weep. The Prophet continued to weep, and when he could find his voice, he said, Not this do I forbid. These are the promptings of tenderness and mercy, and he that is not merciful, unto him shall no mercy be shown. O Ibrahim, if it were not that the promise of reunion is sure, and that this is a path which all must tread, and that the last of us shall overtake the first, verily we should grieve for thee with a yet greater sorrow. Yet are we stricken indeed with sorrow for thee, O Ibrahim. The eye weepeth, and the heart grieveth, nor say we aught that would offend the Lord. He spoke words of comfort now to Maria and Cyrene, assuring them that Ibrahim was in paradise. Then, having left them for a brief while, he returned with Abbas and his son Fadl. The young man washed the body and laid it out, while the two older men sat and watched him. Then it was borne forth to the cemetery on its little bier. The Prophet led the funeral prayer and prayed again for his son at the edge of the grave after Usama and Fadl had laid in it the body. When the earth had been heaped over it, he still lingered at the graveside, and calling for a skin of water, he bade them sprinkle it over the grave. Some unevenness had been left in the earth, and noticing this, he said, When one of you doeth aught, let him do it to perfection. And smoothing it over with his hand, he said of his own particular action, No harm it doth, nor good, but it giveth relief unto the soul of the afflicted. He had already stressed more than once the need to make perfection one's aim in every earthly act, and many of his sayings indicate that this aim must be unworldly and detached. Ali is said to have summed up the Prophet's guidance in this respect as follows. Do for this world as if to live for ever, and for the next as if to die upon the morrow. To be always ready to depart is to be detached. Be in this world as a stranger or as a passer-by, the Prophet said. On the day of Ibrahim's death, not long after his burial, there was an eclipse of the sun, but when some of the people attributed it to the Prophet's bereavement, he said, The sun and the moon are two signs of the signs of God. Their light is not dimmed for any man's death. If ye see them eclipsed, ye should pray until they be clear. At times he spoke of many of the signs by which men might know that the coming to pass of the final things was near. And as one of the signs, he mentioned the excessive height of the buildings that men would build. But that prophecy was made on a great occasion, which must be chronicled more fully, on the authority of Omar's son Abdullah repeating the words of his father. Umar said, One day when we were sitting with the Messenger of God, there came unto us a man whose clothes were of exceeding whiteness and whose hair was of exceeding blackness, nor were there any signs of travel upon him, although none of us knew him. He sat down knee unto knee opposite the Prophet, upon whose thighs he placed the palms of his hands, saying, O Muhammad, tell me what is the surrender? Islam. The Messenger of God answered him, saying, The surrender is to testify that there is no God but God, and that Muhammad is God's messenger, to perform the prayer, bestow the alms, fast Ramadan, and make, if thou canst, the pilgrimage to the Holy House. He said, Thou hast spoken truly. And we were amazed that having questioned him, he should corroborate him. Then he said, Tell me what is faith, Iman? He answered, To believe in God and his angels and his books and his messengers and the last day, and to believe that no good or evil cometh but by his providence. Thou hast spoken truly, he said. And then, Tell me what is excellence, Ihsan? He answered, to worship God as if thou sawest him. For if thou seest him not, yet seeth he thee. Thou hast spoken truly, he said. And then? Tell me of the hour. He answered, The question thereof knoweth no better than the questioner. He said, Then tell me of its signs. He answered, That the slave girl shall give birth to her mistress, and that those who were but barefoot, naked, needy herdsmen, shall build buildings ever higher and higher. Then the stranger went away, and I stayed a while after he had gone. And the prophet said to me, O Umar, knowest thou the questioner, who he was? I said, God and his messenger know best. He said, It was Gabriel. He came unto you to teach you your religion. When the prophet was in Medina during Ramadan, it was his wont to make a spiritual retreat in the mosque during the middle 10 days of the month, and some of his companions would do the same. But this year, having kept the 10 appointed days, he invited his companions to remain in retreat with him for another 10 days, that is, until the end of the month, which they did. It was in Ramadan every year that Gabriel would come to him to make sure that nothing of the revelation had slipped from his memory. And this year, after the retreat, the prophet confided to Fatima, as a secret not yet to be told to others, Gabriel reciteth the Quran unto me, and I unto him once every year. But this year he hath recited it with me twice. I cannot but think that my time hath come. The month of Shawwal passed, and in the 11th month of the year it was proclaimed throughout Medina that the Prophet himself would lead the pilgrimage. The news was sent to the desert tribes, and multitudes flocked to the oasis from all directions, glad of the opportunity of accompanying the messenger at every step of the way. The pilgrimage would be unlike any that had taken place for hundreds of years. The pilgrims would all be worshippers of the one God, and no idolater would desecrate the holy house with the performance of any heathen rites. 5 days before the end of the month, the Prophet set out from Medina at the head of over 30,000 men and women. At sunset, on the 10th day after leaving Medina, the Prophet reached the pass through which he had entered Mecca on the day of the victory. There he spent the night, and the next morning he rode down to the hollow. When he came within sight of the Kaaba, he raised his hands in reverence, letting fall the rein of his camel, which he then took up in his left hand, and with his right hand held out in supplication, he prayed, O God, increase this house in the honour and magnification and bounty and reverence and piety that it receiveth from mankind. He entered the mosque and made the 7 rounds of the Kaaba, after which he prayed at the station of Abraham. Then, going out to Safa, he went 7 times between it and Marwa, and those who were with him did their best to record in their memories the exact words of praise and prayer that he uttered at every station. When the sun had passed its zenith, the prophet preached a sermon, which he began, after praising God, with the words, Hear me, O people, for I know not if ever I shall meet with you in this place after this year. Then he exhorted them to treat one another well, and gave them many reminders of what was commanded and what was forbidden. Finally, he said, I have left amongst you that which, if ye hold fast to it, shall preserve you from all error, a clear indication, the book of God and the word of his prophet. O people, hear my words and understand. He then imparted to them a revelation which he had just received, and which completed the Quran, for it was the last passage to be revealed. This day the disbelievers despair of prevailing against your religion, so fear them not, but fear me. This day have I perfected for you your religion and fulfilled my favour unto you. And it hath been my good pleasure to choose Islam for you as your religion." He ended his brief sermon with an earnest question. "O people, have I faithfully delivered unto you my message?" A powerful murmur of assent, "O God, yea," arose from thousands of throats, and the vibrant words, "Allahumma na'am," rolled like thunder throughout the valley. The prophet raised his forefinger and said, "O God, bear witness." The prophet continually spoke of paradise, and when he did so, it was as a man who sees what he describes. This impression was confirmed by many other signs, as, for example, when he once stretched out his hand as if to take something and then drew it back. He said nothing, but some of those who were with him noticed his action and questioned him about it. "I saw paradise," he said, "and I reached out for a cluster of its grapes. Had I taken it, ye would have eaten of it as long as the world endureth." They had grown accustomed to thinking of him as one who is already, in a sense, in the hereafter. Perhaps it was partly for this reason that when he spoke of his death, and when he inferred indirectly, as sometimes now he did, that it might be imminent, his words made little impression on them. Moreover, despite his 63 years, he still had the stature and grace of a much younger man. His eyes were still bright, and there were only a few white hairs in his black hair. One night he called to a freedman of his in the small hours, Abu Muwahiba, and said, "I have been commanded to pray forgiveness for the people of the cemetery, so come thou with me." They went out together, and when they reached the Baqi, the prophet said, "Peace be on you, O people of the graves. Rejoice in your state, how much better it is than the state of men now living. Dissensions come like waves of darkest night, the one following hard upon the other, each worse than the last." Then he turned to Abu Muwahiba and said, "I have been offered the keys of the treasuries of this world, and immortality therein followed by paradise, and I have been given the choice between that and meeting my Lord and paradise." "O dearer than my father and my mother," said Abu Muwahiba, "take the keys of the treasuries of this world and immortality therein followed by paradise." But he answered him, saying, "I have already chosen the meeting with my Lord and paradise." Then he prayed for forgiveness for the people of the Baqi. It was at dawn that day, or perhaps the next day, that his head ached as he had never known it to ache, but he nonetheless went to the mosque, and after leading the prayer, he mounted the pulpit and invoked blessings on the martyrs of Uhud, as if, so it was said afterwards, he were doing it for the last time. Then he said, "There is a slave amongst the slaves of God, unto whom God hath offered the choice between this world and that which is with him, and the slave hath chosen that which is with God." When he said this, Abu Bakr wept, for he knew that the prophet was speaking of himself, and that the choice meant imminent death. The prophet saw that he had understood, and telling him not to weep, he said, "O people, the most beneficent of men unto me, in his companionship and in that which his hand bestoweth, is Abu Bakr. And if I were to take from all mankind an inseparable friend, he would be Abu Bakr. But companionship and brotherhood of faith is ours, until God unite us in his presence." It was on that occasion that he said, looking round at the multiple entrances into the mosque from the private houses which surrounded it, "Behold these doors that intrude upon the mosque. Let them be walled up, save only the door of Abu Bakr." Before leaving the pulpit, he said, "I go before you, and I am your witness. Your tryst with me is at the pool, which verily I behold from here, where now I stand. I fear not for you, that ye will set up gods beside God. But I fear for you this world, lest ye seek to rival one another in worldly gains." The effort of speech to the congregation had increased his fever, and wishing to let Aisha know that he was ill, he went briefly to visit her. She also was suffering from a headache, and when he entered her room she moaned, "Oh, my head!" "Nay, Aisha," said the prophet, "it is, oh, my head." But he looked at her searchingly, as if to seek some sign of mortal sickness in her face, and finding none, he said, "I wished that it might be," he meant her death, "whilst yet I was alive, that I might ask forgiveness for thee, and invoke mercy upon thee, and shroud thee, and pray over thee, and bury thee." Aisha could see that he was ill, and she was alarmed at the tone of his voice, but she tried to make light of it, and succeeded in bringing a brief smile to his face. Then he repeated, "Nay, but it is, oh, my head," and left her. He tried to do as he did when he was well, and continued to lead the prayers in the mosque as usual. But his illness increased, until the hour came when he could pray only in a sitting position, and he told the congregation that they also should pray seated. On his return to the apartment of the wife whose day it was, he asked her, "Where am I tomorrow?" And she named the wife to whom he would go. "And where the day after tomorrow?" he asked. Again she answered, but struck by his insistence, and sensing that he was impatient to be with Aisha, she told the other wives, whereupon they all came to him and said, "O Messenger of God, we have given our days with you unto our sister Aisha." He accepted their gift, but was now too weak to walk unaided, so Abbas and Ali helped him to Aisha's apartment. At the next call to prayer, the prophet felt he could no longer lead it, even though he remained seated, so he said to his wives, "Tell Abu Bakr to lead the people in prayer." But Aisha feared that it would greatly pain her father to take the place of the prophet. "O Messenger of God," she said, "Abu Bakr is a very sensitive man, not strong of voice, and much given to weeping when he reciteth the Quran." "Tell him to lead the prayer," said the prophet, as if she had not spoken. She tried again, this time suggesting that Umar should take his place. "Tell Abu Bakr to lead the prayer," he reiterated. Aisha had thrown a glance of appeal at Hafsa, who now began to speak, but the prophet silenced her with the words, "Ye are even as the women that were with Joseph. Tell Abu Bakr to lead the people in prayer. Let the blamer find fault, and let the ambitious aspire. God and the believers will not have it otherwise." He repeated the last sentence three times, and for the rest of his illness, Abu Bakr led the prayer. The prophet lay much of the time with his head resting on Aisha's breast or on her lap. But when Fatima came, Aisha would withdraw a little to allow the father and daughter some privacy together, and at one of these visits Aisha saw him whisper something to his daughter, who thereupon began to weep. Then he confided to her another secret, and she smiled through her tears. As she was leaving, Aisha asked her what he had said, and she answered that they were secrets she could not divulge. But later she said to her, "The prophet told me he would die in that illness whereof he died, and therefore I wept. Then he told me that I would be the first of the people of his house to follow him, and therefore I laughed." He suffered much pain in his illness, and one day, when it was at its worst, his wife Safiya said to him, "O prophet of God, would that I had what thou hast." Whereupon some of the other wives exchanged glances and whispered one to another that this was hypocrisy. The prophet saw them and said, "Go rinse your mouths." They asked him why, and he said, "For your maligning of your companion. By God, she speaketh the truth in all sincerity." The next day was Monday, the 12th of Rabi al-Awwal, in the 11th year of Islam, that is, the 8th day of June in the year AD 632. Early that morning the prophet's fever abated, and although he was exceedingly weak, the call to prayer decided him to go to the mosque. The prayer had already begun when he entered, and the people were almost drawn away from it for joy at the sight of him, but he motioned them to continue. For a moment he stood to watch them, and his face shone with gladness as he marked the piety of their demeanour. Then, still radiant, he made his way forward, helped by Fadl and by Thauban, one of his freedmen. "I never saw the prophet's face more beautiful than it was at that hour," said Anas, his servant. Abu Bakr had been conscious of the stir throughout the ranks behind him. He knew that it could only have one cause, and that the man he now heard approaching must be the prophet. So, without turning his head, he stepped back, but the prophet placed his hand on his shoulder and pressed him forwards again in front of the congregation, saying, "Lead thou the prayer," while he himself sat on the right of Abu Bakr and prayed seated. The prophet returned to Aisha's apartment, helped by Fadl and Thauban. Ali and Abbas followed them there, but did not stay long, and when they came out, some men who were passing asked Ali how the prophet was. "Praise be to God," said Ali, "he is well." But when the questioners had gone on their way, Abbas took Ali's hand and said, "I swear I recognize death in the face of God's messenger, even as I have ever been able to recognize it in the faces of our clansmen." The prophet had now returned to his couch and was lying with his head upon Aisha's breast as if all his strength had been used. Nonetheless, when her brother Abdurrahman entered the room with a toothstick in his hand, she saw the prophet looking at it in such a way that she knew he wanted it. So she took it from her brother and gnawed upon it to soften it. Then she gave it to the prophet, who rubbed his teeth with it vigorously despite his weakness. Not long afterwards he lost consciousness, and Aisha thought it was the onset of death. But after an hour he opened his eyes. She then remembered his having said to her, "No prophet is taken by death until he hath been shown his place in paradise, and then offered the choice to live or to die." And she understood that this had been accomplished, and that he had returned from a vision of the hereafter. "He will not now choose us," she said to herself. Then she heard him murmur, "With the supreme communion in paradise, with those upon whom God hath showered his favour, the prophets and the saints and the martyrs and the righteous, most excellent for communion are they." Again she heard him murmur, "O God, with the supreme communion." And these were the last words she heard him speak. Gradually his head grew heavier upon her breast, until the other wives began to lament, and Aisha laid his head on a pillow and joined them in lamentation. When the news came to him, Abu Bakr addressed the people in the mosque. After giving praise to God, he said, "O people, whoso hath been wont to worship Muhammad, verily Muhammad is dead. And whoso hath been wont to worship God, verily God is living and dieth not." Then he recited the following verses, which had been revealed after the battle of Uhud. "Muhammad is but a messenger, and messengers have passed away before him. If he die or be slain, will ye then turn upon your heels? Whoso turneth upon his heels will thereby do no hurt unto God. And God will reward the thankful." It was as if the people had not known of the revelation of this verse until Abu Bakr recited it that day. They took it from him, and it was on all their tongues. Umar said afterwards, When I heard Abu Bakr recite that verse, I was so astounded that I fell to the ground. My legs would no longer carry me, and I knew that God's messenger had died. All the people of Medina visited him and prayed over him. They came in relays, and each small gathering prayed the funeral prayer. Firstly the men, group after group, and then when all the men had visited him, the women came, and after them the children. That night he was laid in his grave by Ali and the others who had prepared him for burial. Great was the sorrow in the City of Light, as Medina now is called. The companions rebuked each other for weeping, but wept themselves. "Not for him do I weep," said Ayman, when questioned about her tears. "Know I not that he hath gone to that which is better for him than this world? But I weep for the tidings of heaven which have been cut off from us." It was indeed as if a great door had been closed. Yet they remembered that he had said, "What have I to do with this world? I and this world are as a rider and a tree beneath which he taketh shelter. Then he goeth on his way and leaveth it behind him." He had said this, that they, each one of them, might say it of themselves. And if the door had now closed, it would be open for the faithful at death. They still had in their ears the sound of his saying, "I go before you, and I am your witness. Your tryst with me is at the pool." Having delivered his message in this world, he had gone to fulfill it in the hereafter, where he would continue to be, for them and for others, but without the limitations of life on earth, the key of mercy, the key of paradise, the spirit of truth, the happiness of God. "Verily God and his angels whelm in blessings," the prophet. "O ye who believe, invoke blessings upon him and give him greetings of peace." That is the end of Muhammad, His Life Based on the Earliest Sources, by Martin Lings, read by Sean Barrett, published by Meme Audio.